everything that we need for the computer systems, our security systems, our perception monitoring. If we've got a question about our email, a computer, Windows, any kind of situation that we run into,
we run to Ruben.
Oh, his customer service is great. Along with being extremely professional, they're very personable. It's not like somebody sitting in here and talking a bunch of computer speak to you. They actually listen. They answer your questions in English, which is really good. And they don't look at you like you're absolutely crazy, you know, when you say, my computer is making this really strange picture or whatever it's doing. And they always seem to come up with a solution. It's really great. It works really well for us.
RB Technologies cares about their customers. Online at rbtechvt.com. RB Technologies, efficiency through technology.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. A little slushy out there this morning. Take a little bit of extra time. Roads actually aren't that bad. Interstate, at least, I can speak from experience here this morning. Just a little crusty, a little crunchy. Might take you a little extra time, but looking like everything's pretty smooth out there. Back roads I will not speak for, so please exercise some caution. Because, you know, we need each and every one of you around here, at least for another couple of hours, and then you're on your own. Coming up on the program today, it is Martin Luther King Day. We're going to chat about service, and one of the areas that is of great public service, and interestingly, more Vermonters than any other state, at least per capita-wise, serving in the Peace Corps. And we're going to talk with a nice young man here coming up in just a moment who's recently back from Senegal. You can join us on the program this morning at any time at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. We'll have extra bonus time for you to call in on the program today because our White House crew is taking Martin Luther King Day off. We can also, among the other topics I want to get to later on in the program today, we can talk about this study that came out Friday that estimates the gobs of money that Vermont could make if it were to legalize marijuana, and a few other stories that I want to get to as well, too, including some discussion about last week's budget address by Governor Shumlin. So, again, you can join us on the program today. We'd love to hear from you at 244-1777. That's our local number. And our toll-free line is 877-291-8255. I guess I probably should have started and hope you had all a great weekend. All right, let's get right down to business here this morning. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Connor LeClaire, who's from Hyde Park. And as I just mentioned, he returned last month from serving in the Peace Corps in Senegal, and he's kind enough to join us here live in our studios. Good morning.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Tell our listeners a little bit about your background. Fifth generation Vermonter.
Yes. My family is originally from Quebec, and I'm a fifth generation Vermonter. We've lived in Hyde Park on the same dairy farm for five generations now. I grew up in Hyde Park. I started going to elementary school, Hyde Park Elementary. Then I changed to Bishop Marshall School in Mooresville. I attended Rice Memorial High School for high school. And then I went to the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts.
When did you graduate from Holy Cross?
2011.
All right. So what's why did you decide to join the Peace Corps?
I think the whole concept of service was really appealing to me. I'm a Roman Catholic. I'm very proud of that. And I think that throughout my life, the concept of service and kind of living your life as someone for others was very important. That was always a very important concept. And I think that the Peace Corps gave me that opportunity after college to really focus on type of work that I appreciated and wanted to explore more, that being third world development, but also kind of gave me the service aspect too, where I was doing a lot of good on the local roots, you know, the local level of society somewhere in the third world.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I think, the two of those together really put me on the Peace Corps track.
Had you done any sort of volunteer work prior to this?
I had. In college, I taught English in Bosnia-Herzegovina for a little over a month. It was almost a month and a half. That was a summer thing I did. That was 2009. And the program I was with was called Builders for Peace. It was run by a retired Harvard professor, Thomas Butler. And what we did is we taught English classes to high school age kids. We also worked to promote dialogue between the three major ethnic groups in Bosnia, Bosnian, Muslim, Serbian and Croatian. Bosnia, of course, being a very difficult part of the world. So the work we did there was wonderful. We got to really talk to the students and their families about their experiences during the war there in the 90s. And it was a very eye-opening experience. I think that really had a lot to do with me going on the Peace Corps track.
What'd you learn on that experience?
I think I had a lot of dialogue with the youth, a lot of my students that I talked with. Like I said, they were high school age kids, about 16 to 18 years old. And I think what it was just talking with them about their experiences, really understanding that, you know, it's not just a visit. It's not just a place of the world that you go and visit. This is a place where people live. And just like Vermont is a lot that I've known in my life, this is a part of the world that they've known throughout their lives. This is all they know, you know. So I think that kind of going there and just really living with the people and really talking with the people really instilled this curiosity to do it more, I suppose.
And you weren't a lot older than them either.
No, I was a junior in college, or going into my junior year of college. So I think I was about 20 years old.
Yeah. So they must have somewhat related to you. I mean, it wasn't like some old guy.
Old professor. I was, you know, we used to play sports. We used to play football and soccer and in our off time. We taught in the morning from about 8 to about 11, 11:30. And then we had the afternoons off. But the afternoons were with your students. So we did sports and we did field trips and, you know, they tried to teach me their language and things like that. So
tough language, huh?
Serbo-Croatian, yeah. It's very much like Russian.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, I think I've forgotten just about everything. But if I had spent another couple months there, I think I would have been able to pick up a lot more. So hopefully in the future, if I ever go back there, I still have a lot of friends there who I've kept in contact with.
So tough place to be a teenager, 16 to 18 years old, I'd imagine.
Yeah, for sure. There's not a lot of opportunities, I think, to really get out of the country. There's a lot more opportunities now, but you know, Bosnia had a lot of problems. Their infrastructure is not that good, and politically, when I was there, it was a very caustic environment. I think it still is.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big deal that Bosnia just qualified for the World Cup this past year,
right.
The first time. That was a really big solidarity moment for the country, and a lot of people were really proud. So hopefully, the country will be able to keep going on that path.
Usually with the Peace Corps, you pick a couple of different countries you want to go to, and then you sort of want it selected for you.
Mm-hmm.
So how'd you wind up going to Senegal?
When I did my application, they had you choose regions that you preferred. So I chose West Africa as my first pick. My second pick was North Africa, and my third pick was Eastern Europe. West Africa, I thought, was a good fit for me because many of the countries are Francophone or French-speaking.
Okay, yeah, like Senegal.
Senegal, yeah.
So you speak French?
I speak French. My family is French-Canadian. I grew up speaking French with my grandparents and my mother, and we speak English at home, but sometimes when my grandparents are with my Canadian, my family up in Canada, we speak French. So
yeah, okay, so that makes sense.
And I have agricultural experience too. I lived on a farm. I've grown up on a farm. I've worked on a farm, our fifth generation farm. So that's a very important thing too. And it was a good fit because with my agricultural experience and with my language, West Africa was a Peace Corps thought that was a really good fit for me. And that's what when I envisioned myself serving in Peace Corps, I envisioned myself serving in West Africa. So it was a great fit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was happy to get service there.
We're talking with Connor LeClaire. He's just recently back from Senegal, where he served in the Peace Corps. If you have any comments or questions, you can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. What'd you know about Senegal before you went?
Not a whole lot. I knew it was a Francophone country. You know, during French classes in high school and college, there was always a section in the textbooks that said, you know, Francophone Africa, and Senegal was always the country that was highlighted. But apart from that, I really didn't know a whole lot. I knew the capital. I knew Dakar.
Right.
And that was from my geographic B days back in middle school. But apart from that, I didn't really know too much about it.
That's pretty good if you do that, even from geographic B days. Tell our listeners a little bit about the country. Where is it? What are its major industries?
Okay. Senegal is in Western Africa. It's actually the westernmost country in Africa. It borders Mauritania. Mauritania is to the north of Senegal, and then Mali's to the east. Guinea-Conakry. Is to the south along with Guinea-Bissau. And in the southeast, you have you're also close to Sierra Leone and Liberia as well. So it's very much West African. Senegal was colonized by France in the 1800s, and one of their big exports now is peanuts. So with the work I did in Senegal, I did a lot of work with, I did agricultural, sustainable agriculture. So we did a lot of work with peanuts as well. Senegal is a Muslim country. It's over 90% Muslim. They have a large Catholic minority, Christian minority, mostly Catholic. It's like 8%, I think it's almost 8%. The Christians are mostly in school, cities, concentrated in cities, urban environments. Senegal is dominated by its largest tribe, which is the Wolof people. They dominate the government. They dominate kind of social systems in the country, the political system as well. I was in the eastern part of the country living with a family or a tribe in a village that was not Wolof. They were the Bambara people. And the Bambara people are the majority in Mali. And they have a large population in Guinea-Conakry and Burkina Faso and kind of that area, more interior West Africa.
Okay.
So my reality in Senegal was more of a mix between Guinea and Mali as opposed to straight Senegal with the Wolof culture. As you get farther east in Senegal, there's less and less Wolof people. They're more concentrated in the western part of the country along the coast.
Okay.
So.
Mm-hmm. Poor country?
Yeah, very poor country. I think it's ranked 193 in the world in terms of GDP or something like that. Literacy is pretty good. The education system in Senegal is not too bad. It's based on the French colonial model. So French is the ability to speak French is it's a blessing, and it's also a goal for a lot of people. It kind of represents success and education and what a Senegalese person should be. Not a lot of opportunities for females in the country, especially after the equivalent of middle school here in the States. There's in Senegal, high school is called lycée, and I found that generally not a lot of girls continued their education or were able to, especially coming from a village environment originally. More urban children, more urban, in a more urban environment, were able to continue their education. But from a rural village environment where you're living in the middle of the bush, you know, not a lot of access to running water or electricity or even other villages for that matter, no good infrastructure, the opportunities are very limited, especially for girls.
So it's more poverty than the government policy?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
What's the political system?
The political system, Senegal has a president, and they have a big parliament. Like I said, the parliament is dominated by the Wolof. So it's very tribal in many ways. Also, Islam plays a very important role. There's Islamic brotherhoods in Senegal. Now, in Islam, there's three big schools of Islam in the world: Sunni Islam, Shia, and Sufi. Sufi is kind of a catch-all for a lot of different kind of minority Muslim groups that are more mystical and probably more progressive. In Senegal, there's big Sufi groups, for example. So the Islamic Brotherhoods in Senegal, they control block votes in the election system there.
Okay.
But they're very different. They're more politically inclined, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
244-1777 is our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. It's about 13 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds as though, like a lot of places, that it's a completely different world in the rural areas as opposed to in, like, Dakar.
Yes. In the rural areas, you have a lot of underdevelopment, I guess that's the word. The village I was in Senegal had about 2,500 people. And those people lived in huts made out of concrete blocks with grass roofs.
Okay.
And they lived in buildings that we called bâtiments, the French word for just building, with kind of corrugated steel roofing, you know, concrete block building with corrugated steel roofing. And that was, if you had steel roofing, you were high class because you could afford it. It was really hot when the sun was beating on it for 8 months out of the year, but
yeah,
still. And the quality of life there was arguably, is actually, I think, a little bit higher than the city, because the city has electricity usually, and it has a lot of, you know, infrastructure and things like that. However, the quality of life in the city is a lot worse because you have a lot more slums and you have a lot poorer people who are there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the village is kind of the whole difference in someone's wealth and well-being, etc. It's not as noticeable in the village because everybody's about the same level. But in the city, you get a lot more poor people that are just visible. You also have a lot of, you know, a third world city is not like a city that we know here in the States. It's a city in transition. There's a lot of half-constructed buildings. There's a lot of, you know, people running around, children and dogs and even farm animals in downtown, you know, across from the presidential palace, for example.
Yeah.
But there are some places of the city that are very nice, like the expatriate communities are generally, you know,
yeah,
very nice communities,
right,
with manicured lawns and servants and security, you know, security and stuff like that. But, you know, Senegal is it's a big city. Dakar is a very big city. And Dakar has over a quarter of the Senegalese population. Now, you said Senegal has about 13 million people. Dakar has over 4 million people just in
okay.
the city. So that's a big percentage of the total population of the country.
Yeah.
And in a third world environment where, you know, basic services are not really available, you can imagine that many people in a small environment. It's not really a good place to live for a lot of people.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. Let's head up to Stowe. Brent, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good, thank you. I have a quick question for your guest.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. LeClaire, my son is very interested in Peace Corps service and, you know, very much motivated toward the idea of service outside the country, outside of his comfort zone. And I'm wondering what kind of advice you might have for him. He's a college graduate as well.
Mm-hmm.
But what kind of advice you might have for him just to get started in the process and how to find the right area,
okay,
physical area to apply to?
Yeah, well, thanks for your call, Brent. I'll do my best to give you some good advice. I think one of the first things to keep in mind as he starts the process itself is to give himself a lot of time. The application process for me took over a year. So, and there's
what?
A lot of things involved.
Wow.
Yeah, over a year. There was a lot of medical clearance, background investigation. The application process itself took a long time because the Peace Corps is actually starting to become a very competitive organization. So I think, you know, give yourself plenty of time. I'm not sure when he wants to. You said he's a recent college graduate, so maybe he would like to start this year, the end of this year, or maybe in 2016. So I think giving yourself plenty of time is a good piece of advice there. What he's going to have to do with the medical process is he's going to have to get a lot of, he's going to get a physical, he's going to have to get his eyes checked out. Just, you know, the Peace Corps wants to make sure they're sending somebody healthy over there, because a lot of the places in the world that volunteers get are, the quality of life there, just the health in general is pretty poor, standards of health. So I think that's a good thing to do. Second, I think when I was in my service, the biggest piece of advice that I could give anybody as a current volunteer was just to have patience, because, you know, culturally there's so many differences, and it's, you know, someone who going in the Peace Corps with a lot of ideas about work they want to do and just a good
all eager beaverish,
ethic and strong, you know, strong mentality. I think that what progress is doesn't necessarily translate. What you think progress is doesn't necessarily translate to different cultures. So just have a lot of patience, and, you know, there's going to be many times in his service that he feels frustrated, and I think that if he just stays true to himself and has a lot of patience with himself and his projects, I think that's the best he can do, that's the best piece of advice I can give.
You seemed pretty convinced that this was something you were going to do. There wasn't a lot of, you know, doesn't sound like there was a lot of back and forth on that, but not necessarily, I think, maybe the case with Brent's kid. So what are the critical questions that you should ask yourself in terms of knowing whether or not you're actually ready to do something like this?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, Mark. I think for me, it was always something that I knew I was going to do. So I was always prepared for it, and I was always going to be the next step in my life. If that's not necessarily the case for some people, I think that you should really get your facts straight about a part of the world that you may want to serve in. Obviously, when you think of Peace Corps, you probably think of, you know, glamorous Peace Corps positions and, you know, living in a thatched hut in Africa, which was my case, or even living in a jungle and, you know, with watching zebras walk by. And, you know, that's great. And you're going to see time. There's going to be plenty of times in your service when you wake up and you see beautiful things and beautiful sights. But I think we call that the honeymoon period when you're in service, because
right,
everything's flashy and new and, you know, wonderful.
Yeah.
But most of your service is going to be, you know, working in really difficult conditions. And I think you really have to ask yourself if, you know, maybe what do I want, and what do I think it might be a better fit for me that'll make me happiest and healthiest throughout my service. And some people, that's an urban environment. Other people, that's a Peace Corps position in Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm,
or it's a Peace Corps position in Central America. And there's so many different programs in Peace Corps, too. There's education, there's health, environment, community economic development, youth development, agriculture, and Peace Corps response as well. So of those programs, I think it's really kind of necessary to pick which one or which couple are the ones that you really want to work with the most. Which one you think is the best fit, and really try to do your research and see, okay, if I'm going to be doing this work, environmental development work, for example, in Central America, where I want to do, what is my work going to look like there?
Mm-hmm.
What's my reality every day? Because every day is every day for over 2 years. So I just want to make sure that you know what you're getting into and be prepared for it.
Can't hit a magic button and be back in your living room.
No.
How many times did you want to do that, though?
I think there were several times in the hot season in Senegal. I was never homesick, so I was very lucky. But I think during the hot season in Senegal, which was roughly from about April, maybe mid-March to about June or July, right before the rains really came in earnest, it was really hot. And you had days when it was in the 120s, sometimes 130 degrees. Oof. And it's just, you know, sometimes there's a breeze. Most of the time it's just kind of dead and there's just no breeze and it's really hot.
Wow.
And you're sitting in your hut, you know, without electricity, without running water, and the water you're drinking is room temperature. Yeah. So inside it's like 115 or something. And there are times when I was really missing the nice cold snow back home. And so, you know, days like today are wonderful because I just don't take them for granted anymore.
Right, right. You have to make a 2-year commitment, a 1-year commitment. What's the commitment you make?
It's a 2-year commitment. It's a 2-year commitment for regular Peace Corps. I was in regular Peace Corps.
Okay.
I just briefly mentioned there's a program called Peace Corps Response, which is a program that's more oriented towards professionals who are already set in their jobs. And that's for anywhere from, I think, 6 months to a year. But that's a whole different program.
Okay.
Usually, if you just come out of college or you have a little bit of work experience, probably a Peace Corps position is better for you. But if you're a little bit older and have a little bit more professional experience and you still want to get that volunteer experience, I think Peace Corps Response would be a pretty good position, too.
We're going to take a short commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about your adventure in Senegal. We'll also talk about the incredibly high number of Vermonters that are volunteering for the Peace Corps. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Green Mountain Power, Vermont's energy company of the future, is offering an exciting new line of energy-efficient products and services, like heat pumps and water heaters to save you money, up to 50% compared to oil and propane. Improve the comfort of your home and help the environment by using less energy. To learn more, visit greenmountainpower.com or call 888-835-4672. Green Mountain Power, generating possibilities together.
Looking for a loan for your Vermont business, childcare, or nonprofit organization? Look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Because at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits, even if the bank says you're not quite ready for a loan. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we focus on people, not profits. We'll work closely with you before and after you get your loan to make sure you get what you need to succeed. The Vermont Community Loan Fund makes loans to early stage companies and established businesses ready to take the next step. We lend to farms and food producers, high-tech businesses, manufacturers, retailers, childcare businesses, affordable housing developers, service providers, and other nonprofit organizations. We make loans to Vermonters doing business right here at home and around the world. So if you're looking for financing to help your growing business, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Visit us online at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
Maplefields and Irving want you to ski for free. Fill up 3 times with Irving gasoline at their newest Maplefield store in downtown Newport, just off I-91 in St. Johnsbury, or any other Maplefield Irving locations, and you'll be eligible to receive a buy one, get one free lift pass at great local mountains like Burke, Jay Peak, Smugs, and Bolton Valley. With these new Maplefield locations, a great cup of coffee is never far away when you're on your way for an exciting day at the slopes. Come see them during their grand opening celebration in St. Johnsbury on January 22nd, 23rd, or 24th for awesome specials and prizes.
This is Roger Williams from 802 Toyota. On behalf of our entire staff, I would like to thank all of our sales, service, and parts customers for your loyalty and partnership in 2014. We know you expect the best service and prices from us, and that's what keeps you coming back to 802 Toyota for all of your automotive needs. We welcome your feedback, good or otherwise, and we thank you for making our service department the top-ranked Toyota dealer in Vermont for customer satisfaction. Our climate-controlled service drive-thru and our complimentary shuttle service make it easy to keep your car truck in top condition. We stock a huge inventory of pre-owned Toyota cars and trucks, including a great selection of Toyota certified vehicles. Great service, great prices, and our drive to be the best are why you should come in to check us out. We're easy to find. Just click on 802toyota.com, call 844-802-TOYOTA to speak to a member of our helpful customer service team, or drive to exit 7 off I-89 for just 2 minutes off the exit. 802 Toyota, driving to be Vermont's number one Toyota dealer.
Back continuing our discussion, we've been talking this morning with Connor LeClaire. He lives in Hyde Park, and he just recently back from service in the Peace Corps in Senegal, which is in Western Africa. If you have any comments or questions, you're welcome to join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. So what was your actual work? Were you part of a team? How did it work?
Yes, I was doing sustainable development work as an agriculture volunteer in Senegal.
So day-to-day, what did that mean?
Day-to-day. So day-to-day, what I did was I worked with rural farmers in my village and in the local community around, the local community being the four or five villages surrounding my village in the bush, connected by little dirt paths through the bush. So the work I was doing was I was working with local farmers to really introduce more sustainable methods of farming, cost-effective and sustainable. You know, a lot of these people can't afford big, flashy pieces of equipment or fertilizers and things like that that we use every day here in the States or in the developed world in general. But things we take for granted, like compost or crop rotation or, you know, improved technologies relating to trees or field development, permaculture design, things like that, conservation farming, just good ideas that could really make a big change if they were implemented on a mass, on a large scale.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, very grassroots things, a lot of, you know, teaching, training people on extended technologies, new technologies, a lot of tree work, tree grafting, tree nurseries, you know, things like that. I also extended improved varieties of seed that were given to Senegal or given to me, the Peace Corps in general, by the Feed the Future program or USAID Senegal, partnered with the Senegalese Agricultural Research Institute to extend improved varieties of seeds that were, you know, scientifically engineered or something that would give more yield with less water and in more drought environments that could still produce pretty well. So just trying to kind of do what we can to make Senegal more sustainable, but really do it on the grassroots level and really try to work with the farmers that were most interested in the change itself. Because you can't force change on people, obviously. You know, these people have been farming the same way for generations. And,
right.
You know, what do you know? You're just another foreigner coming and saying, do this, or you should do this.
Right.
But I think, you know, really by working with people and really just living with them and understanding what their lives are like. And, you know, I was there for over 2 years, so I saw the agricultural calendar twice.
Right.
And I saw the religious calendar twice. I saw a lot of, you know, neat events like baptisms and weddings and religious holidays. So I had a, you know, appreciation for the culture, and they also accepted me as one of their own. And then when you get to that level, you can start making the biggest changes, or just people take you more seriously. You're not a foreigner. You're one of them. And I think that the work I was doing, agricultural, you know, sustainability, was my second year became something that I had a lot more success with.
Mm-hmm.
I could actually make the most change with.
How long do you think it took for you to really get accepted?
I think it took anywhere from about 6 years to a, or I'm sorry, 6 months to a year.
Yeah.
I think it changed. You know, it depends per volunteer. It depends for volunteer personality, how much a volunteer wants to study the language, how much they want to struggle with it, how many risks they want to take, how brave they are, etc. It can be pretty daunting when you get to a village and you only speak the, you know, a little bit of the language, and everybody is really excited to see you, and you're just really tired because you met, you know, 300 people already that day, and you just want to just sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, 300 more people want to meet you, and
right.
It can be really stressful. But I think that, you know, through time and as you get more experience with it, and you spend more time there, and you know, people forgive your faults. You know, in many ways, you're given like a green card because they treat you like one of their kids who doesn't necessarily understand cultural
right.
expectations or, you know, treatment of elders and how you do things, cultural norms. And it's refreshing because I think after about 6 months of being really proactive about your service and really, you know, accepting your faults and failings, say, you know, I'm still here. I'm still, you know, I'm getting better every day, and people understand that.
Yeah.
For me, it was about six months to a year.
Did you have any really terrible faux pas in the cultural norms category?
In Senegal, there's a lot of, they have a lot of, greetings have a lot of importance in the society. And it's not just saying hi to people when you walk into the room. It's going up to each and every person and shaking their hand and asking them how their family is and if they're without evil and how, you know, how are their cows and did they sleep a, you know, peaceful night. And that's just the bare beginning. You know, you could spend 5 minutes talking to this, you know, people, every person in the room. And, you know, that's a big thing. And that was difficult for me to accept and to to get used to.
Yeah, to build an election.
Yeah,
time.
For me, you know, I walk into a room and kind of give a general greeting to people and say, you know, hey, I'm, you know, great to see you. I hope you guys are all well and you all slept in peace. Well, that doesn't quite cut it.
Yeah.
Especially if there's elders in the room or, you know, important people like the chief or the imam, the more like the Islamic priest, if you will.
Yeah.
If they're in the room too, you have to go greet them first. Or, you know, if there's some type of dignitary from another village, then it's important that you greet them too.
Okay. So that's why I got such a nice greeting when you came in this morning.
Oh, yeah.
I appreciate that.
How are your cows? Did you sleep in peace, Mark?
I actually slept all right last night.
Oh,
thanks
great.
For asking.
Great.
Let's head down to Corinth. Forbes, how are you doing this morning? How are your cows, Forbes?
Snowbound.
Okay.
That's for sure. Kind of interesting. I'm wondering the concept of the Peace Corps. It's a very large organization, and I always have a concern, of course, for our country, but I was wondering, they felt that things were all hunky-dory here in the United States, and the amount of efforts that we are expending to other countries and whatnot, how that interplays with some of our problems and what his objectives are.
Mm. I'm not sure I totally understand the question.
I think maybe, Forbes, if I can address your question a little bit, I think the top three goals of the Peace Corps are, the first one is to help the people of interested countries in meeting their need for trained men and women. The second one is to help promote a better understanding of Americans on the part of people served. And the third one is to help promote better understanding of other peoples on the part of Americans. So I think in many ways it's like a goodwill organization, you know, and in a world of today where diplomacy is very important and relations between different peoples and different cultures and different religions are very important and should be maintained and cultivated, I think the Peace Corps is among those organizations that does the most good with what they can do.
Well, I totally agree with that. Is there any dialogue as far as the very vast and dedicated group with regards to our country and its problems? I mean, we can just sit here and point out areas in our country that are in dire need of help.
Yeah.
Well, and there are sort of equivalent organizations. I mean, AmeriCorps
is
trying to do a lot of that work.
Mm-hmm. I think, Forbes, with Peace Corps, it's, you know, it's all about kind of promoting understanding and working together with different peoples of different parts of the world. And yeah, America does have a lot of its own challenges and problems that, you know, it needs to overcome and is working on overcoming right now. But from an international standpoint too, you know, America is just one part of a big world. And I think that, you know, most of the problems we hear about in the news or every day are on the world context. And I think that if a country really does the most good it can on the international level, I think a lot of that work will start to be implemented on the home level as well, or the domestic level. Just, you know, a lot of returned Peace Corps volunteers who have wonderful experiences in their service come home to the States and then kind of continue that work of service in you know, that desire for good and change and positive development in their own country, I think, is where a lot of the gift really lies. It really works to really develop people. You know, it makes good people. I think it really, I think what it does is really just develops the type of people that are needed to make the most change in a world today that's, you know, fraught with so many different with problems. I think that the type of mentality it fosters and the type of people it creates is imperative to our country on a domestic level.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks,
yeah,
Forbes.
Thanks for your call.
244-1777, our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. Ebola an issue?
Ebola, yeah. When I was in Senegal, that was, we heard about it all the time. It never directly affected my service. If any of you are familiar with the map of West Africa, Ebola was in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea-Conakry. And those countries are all south of Senegal. Senegal shares a border with Guinea-Conakry.
Mm-hmm.
But Senegal, in my service, and I think to date, has only ever had one confirmed case of Ebola, and it never affected my service there. It affected the service of some of the health volunteers that some of the work they do was in clinics, medical clinics, and working with malaria prevention and things like that. Some of their work, some of their presence in clinics was limited as mm-hmm. a result of Ebola, just as a safety concern, just a measure that was taken. But for me, doing agricultural work in the bush and the countryside, it was never an issue. In the southern part of the country, there's a lot of Ebola awareness that was going on. You had just legions of health volunteers and health workers from all over the world coming in and doing, you know, mass, going through villages and just seeing if there was anybody heard of any Ebola, if there wasn't any Ebola, especially towards the frontier with Guinea.
Right.
But the thing to remember is that in the third world, you know, the countries may share a border, but infrastructure in that part of the world is so poor that for people to be able to travel from, you know, southeastern Guinea in the forest region where it really broke out to Senegal was a big commitment, a really, really difficult thing to do. And for a lot of people, that was one thing they did, you know, once in their lifetime to talk about for the rest of their life.
Right.
So geographically and strategic, you know, very close, but from a realistic standpoint, it was just never really a thing at all.
Did you ever get really sick in your 2 years of service?
I did, yeah. I had a lot of, you know, being from the nice northern climate up here, I had a lot of skin issues. I had a lot of skin infections and things like that. Also, a lot of stomach issues when I first got to country. It was just something that you went through, and eventually my stomach got good, and I didn't get sick for the last year of my service.
What was the diet you were eating?
Oh, I think most of the food I ate was rice-based food. Rice or kind of millet couscous powder with some type of broth on it or a bunch of vegetables that were cooked. All the cooking was done over an open flame, you know, in a village.
What do you think disagreed with you?
I think it was just the bacteria in the food, the bacteria that I'd never encountered before. When I did, it put me under really fast. But I think in my case, it was just a matter of kind of building up the tolerance. And if all the bad bacteria was in my stomach, then it wouldn't give me any more trouble, right?
Right. There you go. I confine it. Yeah. What was it like living in a Muslim country? I mean, predominantly, I mean, very heavily Muslim.
Yeah. Senegal, yeah, it's over 90% Muslim. I lived in a very Muslim part of the country. Everybody I worked with, everybody I interacted with in Senegal, from Senegalese, a Senegalese man or woman, we were all Muslim. It was very interesting, Mark. It was, in the news today, we hear about Islam, I think, for all the wrong reasons. And I lived in a Muslim country for 2 years, and I had a wonderful experience. You know, I was accepted in the community. The people I lived with were very progressive, very interested in me, asking me a lot of questions about not only where I was from in the States and who I was as a person, but just, you know, what my religion was like. And I could openly, I'm a Catholic, like I said, and I was able to openly practice my religion. About 7 miles from my village, there was a large town that had a church in it that I could go to.
Huh.
So I could go, masses every week, and I could go when I had time. So I maybe went to 2 or 3 masses a month or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was never a problem. There's a big Christian population in Senegal, and actually Senegal is renowned in the international community as being very open in terms of religion. There's hardly any friction in between people of different religions there. There's a huge Muslim population, a pretty big Christian minority, and also there's many animists in the southern part of the country. Animism is more traditional African beliefs. So you're not Christian, you're not Muslim. You know, these are the people, the ones that maybe dance around with, you know, carved wooden masks and very beautiful costumes and things like that. Mm-hmm. So those are more traditional beliefs. And there's a big part of the country, a big part of the population in the southern part of Senegal that actively practices animism. It's actually a huge tourist thing. They have the initiation ceremonies with the Basari people and the Bedik people in things like April or May. And it's a very communal thing. You know, I think that a lot of the people I talk to in Senegal are, you know, their tribe is very important, their religion is very important. But I think, first of all, they're Senegalese.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This might be a weird question. Did you make friends? Did you get close to anybody?
I did. Yes, I have. I still remain in contact with my host family. My host family was wonderful. When I was Senegal, the Peace Corps program in Senegal is unique as that volunteers stay with the host family. Now, most of the Peace Corps programs throughout the world today, they have programs in 64 countries. Yeah, most of those 64 countries, you're living on your own.
Yeah.
You know, you do work in a community, but you don't live with a host family. You're very much on your own. You have your own apartment or you have your own house or something like that.
Yeah.
My reality was very different. My host family was wonderful. They were called the Fofana family. They gave me a name, a Senegalese name. I took their last name when I was there. They just saw me as a part of their family. I wasn't a foreigner. I wasn't any different. And I had an identity.
You looked a little different.
Yeah, you know, I stood right out, which is fine. But I think, you know, just culturally and the way he accepted me was wonderful.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I have, you know, my family, I still remain in contact with them. I try to call them as much as I can. And I'm still, you know, trying to keep my bomber so I don't forget it.
What was the name they gave you?
Fofan. Oh, my real name was Mukhtar.
Okay.
Mukhtar. It's an Arabic name.
Does it mean anything?
It means the chosen one.
Okay. That's a little something to live up to.
Exactly, right? I had to, a lot of big shoes to fill.
The chosen one.
Big shoes to fill. And it was special, too, because the name I got was the name of, I had two namesakes, actually, and one was my host mom and my host dad had 10 children. And their third child, their second son, passed away in infancy, and his name was Mukhtar. So me coming into their family kind of completed their family once more, which is very special. My second namesake was my host father's father, the old village chief himself. So I had big shoes to fill. So, you know, it was great because I was, you know, my little host siblings, I grew up an only child in Vermont, and my little host siblings that I lived with, they were like the siblings I never had.
Wow.
You know, I saw one of them was born, and then she was, you know, almost 2 years old when I left, and just seeing little kids grow up, you know, turning into young women, turning from, you know, babies to little children. It's just really special.
So why host families in Senegal and not other places?
I think it has a lot to do with just the culture in Senegal. In Senegal, they have this big concept called teranga, which is a term that means hospitality. And Senegal, the name of Senegal is the country of teranga. It's the country of hospitality. That's what they're known for throughout Africa, you know, throughout the world. So hospitality, they take it very, very important. They take it very seriously. And I think that it just made sense for you to go in there and live with a family and for them to take you in and be your first resource for everything, you know, cultural questions, language questions, just, you know, they're your support network. They're your biggest fans you have there, you know, and they're also Senegalese nationals. So they just make the work that you do, making that the change from what you want to do to the local community. You do a lot of the work through them, and they're wonderful. It was just a good fit. I think it was something that had a lot of promise. I think hopefully it continues.
We're talking with Connor LeClaire. He's from Hyde Park and just recently came back from Senegal, where he was serving in the Peace Corps. So the numbers of Vermonters that serve in the Peace Corps, there was a piece actually that you sent me. I mean, it's incredible. It's so much higher than any other state. I mean, even the second-ranked state is like way behind Vermont. Mm-hmm. So you got any theory on this one?
Traditional Vermont values, I guess. I think Vermont has a history of sustainability and ingenuity that I think is, you know, they're wonderful traits for a Peace Corps volunteer to have. A lot of volunteers from Vermont have rural backgrounds or agricultural backgrounds, or, you know, a lot of them sometimes, you know, can speak French if they have French-Canadian heritage, you know, connections, or Vermont is a very good education system too, so I think that had a lot to do with it. Just kind of the whole idea of service has been fostered throughout their lives, and I think that, you know, things like Green Up Day and helping out your neighbor and going to shovel out the old lady who is snowed in, you know, next door, things like that just kind of subconsciously build up and kind of lend themselves to a desire to serve somewhere in the world. And yeah, I mean, it's incredible. I knew another volunteer in my group of people that my stage, if you will. We call them stages, each group of volunteers. That was from Vermont. She was from Cabot. I knew a couple other ones from Northern New York. I knew several other volunteers from Vermont. And, you know, it was funny. I noticed that no matter where I've been in the world, Mark, or meeting with people my own age or anywhere really, in any context, I find that if you find out that another person is from Vermont and they find out that you're from Vermont, there's just some magical connection that happens there. You know, like if I'm from Ohio and you're from Ohio, maybe it's not quite the same.
Yeah.
But if you're from Vermont, like, oh, wow, like chances are we probably have a couple people that we know in common.
Right.
So, you know, it's just kind of that thing, and I don't really know how to describe it, but it's out there and just kind of lends itself towards teamwork and making a big change, but also kind of having that kind of, you know, a big part of it's idealism, I think, but also it's just kind of the desire to make a change and to just do the most you can and do the most good you can.
244-1777 is our local number. You can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. So do you think you actually made any sort of a difference?
I think so, Mark. You know, it's hard to really, you know, from a qualitative standpoint or a quantitative standpoint, you know, in terms of just numbers and raw data, you know, maybe I helped the lives of 500, maybe 600 people. And from a development standpoint, that's really not a whole lot, considering there's, you know, millions and millions of people in the developing world that, you know, need a lot of help. But, you know, from the relationships I made with my family, with other volunteers, with a lot of my work partners in country, we're just, you know, there's something I'll always remember. And, You know, Peace Corps volunteers, first and foremost, are, you know, kind of ambassadors for the United States of America, you know, and I think that, you know, in many ways, you're the only American that these people are ever going to come across in their whole life.
Right.
And I think that, you know, if you left a really good impression with them, say, wow, like, you know, America's like this. America's like this person. And I think that that's what the most important thing is, you know. I think that, you know, just helping with people and try to get more dialogue, just try to help people to realize more things they can do to that are with resources that are readily available to improve their own lives that don't require a bunch of expertise and, you know, different organizations coming in and throwing money at you and saying, do it this way, do it this way. You know, just kind of building belief and kind of the desire to pick yourself up by your own bootstraps, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I asked you what you learned in Bosnia. So what did you learn in Senegal?
What did I learn? I learned a lot about myself. I think I learned a lot about what is really important in life with regard to just my own values. The type of work I was doing really humbled me in many ways. You know, I'm kind of a perfectionist in many ways. So when I went to Senegal, I really was demanding a lot of myself. And a lot of that just didn't happen for many reasons. And it was really difficult for me to come to terms with that. But I think it helped put my life in perspective. You know, like, I really made a big change and I really helped a lot of people. But at the same time, you know, I really connected with the people too. I wasn't just this foreign thing that came in and then left. I think I have an identity now. I have people that I'm close with. You know, I have an African family. You know, I have a part of Africa that I relate to and that I have people that I love, you know, and that's, I think, the most important thing.
Well, you are the chosen one.
Well, yeah, right. I can never forget that. But just, you know, I think the important thing is, I think the most I got in my service is that, you know, on paper, these people are people that you have nothing in common with at all.
Right.
And that on paper, you shouldn't have anything to do with or get along with at all. But really, that doesn't matter at all. And these people are people that I'll cherish forever. And I think hopefully I'll be, you know, I'll stay in their minds forever as well.
So what do you do with this now?
Right now, I'm actively searching for jobs. I think a fit in the development field is good.
You
sustainable
think?
Development.
Maybe? Really?
I think
huh.
so. You know,
wow,
I just,
what a shock.
I think I have a unique, unique perspective on how projects work and what projects are a good idea for a certain part of the world at a certain time. You know, realistically, and you know, here we have there's so many calls for charity and to give to this organization and to, you know, send money here and this, you know, to fund a surgery for a child in this part of the world, and you know, there's never going to be any end to that.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, for me to actually experience that on my own and really put not just a human face on it, you know, just to really live it for 2 years, I feel that, you know, most of these projects, they affect the grassroots people, the local people, you know, the everyday and everyday life who, and the trickle-down effect, if you will. And I find that living with those people for so long and seeing what their lives are like for such a long time, I think I see what works, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I see what needs to be done and how they accept it or reject it themselves and what they think is important for them in their life, you know. And I think that, you know, that experience kind of sets me up well for a public diplomacy position or something like that. Or like even a translator position.
Mm-hmm.
I speak a West African language, so there's not many people that can do that. And just, I think I have the desire to kind of, you know, continue that service. You know, it's not so much about, you know, raw data and making good name for your company in terms of look at all the stuff we did, but instead of just like, well, personally, I know that I made a really good change, and I think that I touched the lives of a lot of people, and I, for the good.
I think you really lack poise and maturity, though. I think that's a real weakness you have. How old are you, anyway?
I'm 25.
Jeez. Okay. You know, in terms of your values, what did you sort of clarify? I guess would be maybe the word I would use.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, sustainability is a big one. I think that's very important. The ability to, you know, be self-sufficient as well, to work with ingenuity,
mm-hmm.
to be ingenuous, is that the word? No, that's not the word.
No.
But anyway, it's all right.
Ingenious.
Ingenious, that's it. I just think, you know, those values that, you know, in many ways over there, it was a matter of working with what you had to get the most done. And there was nothing more than that. So you had to arrive at something and you had to work with what you had. And I think, you know, that just opened my mind to what can be done with so little. And these people have so little, and there's so much they can do and so much they've done already, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important. You know, you don't need a lot of things in your life. You don't need all this baggage, it seems, to be happy. A lot of these people that I, you know, working with, they have so little.
Right.
And they're so happy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. How do you explain that to people? I mean, I had the same experience that people in Africa just seem to be remarkably happy and have nothing.
You know, it's hard, Mark. I think that you really have to experience it to understand it. And, you know, people can listen to me talk and to you talk about, oh, we went to this part of the world and it was, you know, a life-changing thing. We learned all these wonderful things. And, you know, you have to see what I'm seeing, right? You have to see it through my eyes, right? You understand what I'm saying. People are like, oh, yeah, we understand. But do they really understand?
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you go there yourself and you really challenge yourself and you really immerse yourself in a part of the world that you have nothing in common with at all, you know, you have to leave everything you know and love behind. Then that's when you really start finding out a lot about yourself
yeah.
and what you really believe in, what your values really are.
So what did you find out in terms of what works and what doesn't work? Were there projects that you got to the end and you said, that was just a total waste of time?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of kind of maybe top-down projects in Senegal. I mean, Senegal has a reputation as being a very, you know, democratically stable African country. They have a wonderful reputation. They kind of can attract a lot of aid opportunities because their country is so stable and has such a good history of political innovation and just leadership in general. You know, and also they're not just a leader in West Africa itself, but, you know, throughout the whole continent.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much more that can be done, you know, and I find that, you know, I find that some companies, when they're just attached with Senegal, like, you know, we did work in Senegal, you know, like, what really did you do? And recently, before I came into this morning, I was looking at some of the numbers from the Feed the Future program that's put out by the U.S. government.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a wonderful program, and they do a lot of good work in the world, and a lot of the work I was doing in Senegal, agricultural work, is that work at the grassroots level society. So I was the guy actually doing research to lead to those numbers showing up on their mm-hmm. website, you know.
Yep.
You know, all these hectares of land that were, you know, farmed under with using improved technologies and things like that. And I think that, you know, it's just that there's a kind of in many ways it's hard to translate between the data and also what really happens. You know, for example, if you say, you know, I worked with a farmer and he farmed seven acres of land using an improved technology. Maybe he only did, you know, three. Maybe he only did four. Maybe he only did, you know, six and a half. Sometimes with the numbers that you report, they don't necessarily get reported as accurately as they should, I think.
Okay.
So I think you get a lot of maybe inflation and things like that
yeah.
in terms of the actual numbers. Like realistically on the ground, for example, you may train, you know, 100 people, okay? And all those people are actually trained in new technology like tree grafting, for example. And what happens is that maybe of those 100 people, you get 10 people that actually implement the practice themselves.
Yeah.
And then of those 10 people, maybe you only get two that succeed.
Right.
You know, 8 people, they failed in the practice. Well, I just killed a tree. I don't really want to do this anymore. But maybe 2 people succeed. So that's, you know, 2 out of 100 is not very many people.
Right.
Okay. And when you put the resources in trying to train 100 people, you know, it doesn't really pay off right there, I suppose.
So what worked? What was a different way of doing things that seemed make more sense?
I think, you know, training of trainers concept was really good. I found that, you know, the Peace Corps approach, and I think sustainable development in general, is about training of trainers. So what it is, you know, there's a disconnect between the local population and the, you know, the foreigner that comes in and tries to extend a certain technology or teach a certain technology. And the whole training of trainers concept works with an organization coming in and training nationals that have been identified as having some type of desire or willingness to learn some type of new technology and then turn around and teach it to their own community.
Yeah.
And I think that's where most of the change happens because they're a local person, you know, they live there, they speak the language and say, you know, look, it's not so much do this, it's more, you know, why don't we try this? Because, you know, they're an expert in the culture already because that's all they know, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's just like, why don't we try this and why don't we see if we can, you know, make this change here. Why don't we just, you know, not the whole field, but maybe a small part of it. Let's try this new technology, see what happens. If we have a good result, then maybe we'll try in a little more next year, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very gradual. It takes a lot of patience. It's not one of these things where, you know, it's a 40-hour a week job where you go in and, all right, you know, 8 to 5 or, you know, 8 to 5 every day, I'm, you know, going in, or, you know, 8 to 4, I'm going in and I'm, all right, I'm working at my office, I'm helping this farmer, helping this farmer, helping this farmer, and he's going to do this, he's going to do this, and he's going to do this. It's not like that.
Yeah.
It isn't. You know, it's very gradual. It takes a lot of time. And I think, you know, as you just kind of spend more quality time with less people. I think that's how the biggest change eventually happens.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
But hardest part of the 2 years for you was what?
I think patience was the big one. Like I said earlier, the whole cultural disconnect with regard to what quality work actually is and what good time management skills actually are. You know, me coming from a 40-hour-a-week type environment to, you know, 24-hour-a-day type environment where you're practically doing something all the time, or even when you're sleeping, you know, people come wake you up and say, oh, like, you know, come check this out, or I want you to come look at this. You know, it can be challenging, especially.
Well, this is a country of instant gratification, so.
For sure.
I mean, that's the expectations that you went there with were probably pretty high.
Yeah, you know, for sure. Like I said earlier, too, I'm kind of a perfectionist, so I like to see a lot of results, you know, driven, results oriented work, and, you know, good quality work too. And you can get the quality work, but it takes 4 or 5 times as long as you would like. And, you know, if I was working a 40-hour-a-week job over there with people that also worked 40-hour-a-week jobs and had that mentality to begin with, it might have been a little.
Yeah.
I could have made more of a difference. But for the time I had, I think it was pretty good.
Congratulations. And, you know, thank you. It's important work that you've done. And you know, everybody can make one small difference, each and every one of us. Especially, I mean, if you're the chosen one, particularly. Thank you very much for coming
in.
I won't bust your chops on that anymore.
Okay.
Connor LeClaire just spent time in Senegal with the Peace Corps. That's going to wrap things up for hour number one. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. No White House report today. FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, AM 550 WDEV, Waterbury, Montpelier.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley.